Thanks. What I was thinking for tonight, as we kind of did something a little bit around the Metta Bhavana, I was thinking tonight we could see if we could have some sort of dialogue about the Metta Bhavana practice. And I was thinking we'd go down and do another meditation, but of course that's not actually an option, is it? So we could do a little one sitting here in our chairs, I suppose, if we want. So we'll see. But I did think that, you know, it might be quite a good opportunity just to see what we've got to say about the Metta Bhavana. It is one of the two main practices that we teach at this centre. And I think Sangharaksh Dabhanti, person who founded this particular Buddhist movement, had the Metta Bhavana alongside the mindfulness of breathing for very particular reasons, yeah. But he did feel his experience of Westerners were that they were quite emotionally, well, what can we say, numbed perhaps, a bit numb, a bit sort of cut off, a bit kind of, yeah. So anyway, I thought it might be worth us just seeing what we can make of that practice. And I think the other thing from my point of view, as someone who's been teaching that practice for a long time now, I'm aware that for a lot of people it's quite a problematic sort of practice. So I think it is a practice that you need to find your way into. Yeah, you need to find some way which you can connect with what it is you're doing. So maybe we can talk about what it is we're trying to do when we're doing that practice and how, for us, we can find a way for it to kind of resonate with us to some degree. You know, look, it's not just we're not just going through the motions with it, as it were. So I haven't got anything particular to say about it without being prompted, at the worst, but we'll see what happens. So we'll just have just open it up for people and see what you've got to ask or say or report about your own attempt, if you do indeed attempt. And if you don't do the practice, it might be quite interesting to know why you don't do it, you know. And we'll see if we can figure out where it fits in with what we're trying to do, really. Yeah? Whatever it is we're trying to do by meditating, how does the Metta Bhavana fit in with that? Yeah? Or does it? Yeah. So anyway, there's some questions for you. Yeah.
I've had problems with that meditation, but it isn't because of being numb. There's plenty of feeling there, but it's very confused. Mm. And I just can't work out what it is I'm trying to feel. And as it's feeling for someone else, what it is I wish on someone else. Because frequently the may they be happy or let's put it straightforward, but healthy, or not necessarily the best thing for some people, for them to be that healthy.
Well, they might not be
So, what I, over the Christmas holiday that we had here, when Kamala Shiva was leading, he made a suggestion that was a real breakthrough for me, because he suggested that we wish that a person should have what is best for them, whatever suits that particular person. And that, I thought, well, that's terrific. Mm. That's something I can wholeheartedly wish for someone. Mm. If I don't have to be specific. Mm. So that was a great help. And I started doing the Metta Bhavana a lot more frequently than I have before. And becoming a bit clearer about what it is I was trying to do. And the other difficulty was getting into the mood to do, or into the state of mind to do. And I found the mantra meditation, 108 mantras, was really good. It just set me up to be able to
Yeah, I think it's a nice way into the practice then. chanting, I think, yeah. It's quite interesting, isn't it? Because what you described there, that made people have what they need, is kind of a very traditional understanding of the practice, yeah? But it's quite interesting to me how that little shift can make a big difference. You know, you just see it in a slightly different way, understand it in a slightly different way, and it kind of opens up for you, you know? Okay. It's really, really interesting that, I think. You know?
There wasn't this little voice in me saying, yes, but maybe that's not the best thing for...
Yeah, you
know,
yeah, yeah.
To get caught
with all of
that interference.
Yeah. Because, of course, additionally, you're wishing them well in the Dharma, really.
Mm.
You know, you're wishing them well in the Dharma, so you're wishing they get what they need in order for them to develop awareness and kindness.
Okay.
Which, as you say, I mean, actually a lot of people develop awareness and kindness through suffering.
Mm. Yeah.
So being happy is not necessarily the best thing for someone, but not that we're sitting in that sort of judgment, you know what I mean? We're not coming into some kind of judgmental relationship with what other people need, if you know what I mean.
Mm.
But yeah, no, it's very interesting, that little shift, and just hearing that shift, you know, the way you do the practice, you know.
I always find the choice of, you know, choosing a friend, choosing somebody, like maybe somebody, a shopkeeper that you go in and see, but you don't actually have a very close relationship with as a neutral person, and then choosing the enemy, and I just think, I find it very, very difficult, and because most of problems that I have are usually friends, in fact, not enemies, or just people have annoying habits like we all do. So I find the title and the division quite difficult of choosing, and then, you know, I think, oh, what is that person, or maybe that person, or maybe both of them, and I can spend my sort of time just sort of vacillating, being stupid about it, and not really getting anywhere. I found today's very, very helpful, because I really could begin, and I love the idea of just listening to somebody breathing beside you, and it somehow had a more visceral... connection rather than a label of friend, neutral, enemy, and then putting them all together. I have problems with the labels, I think, but I think today's practice was hugely helpful, and I do find it much, much easier if I'm downstairs and we do the best partner and I'm just concentrating on people in the room. And they might not be my closest friend or and an enemy either. But somehow, just in that, having them close by, and then the whole group together, sort of, is a much more powerful psychological, well, it seems to, I don't know, it seems to work for me more.
Sure, yeah, yeah. Yeah. I'm just wondering if there's a way that you can sort of let them choose you, rather than you choosing them, if you know what I mean. I mean, this is what I tend to do, if I do those traditional categories, yeah. I'll sort of, maybe I say friend to myself and I just see who comes up. And even if they seem like a very unlikely person, I just stay with it. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
So rather than, because obviously, in a sense, that kind of vacillation is an avoidance of just getting on with it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or obviously can be, yeah. Yeah, no,
it seems really contrived, doesn't it?
Yes, and also...
You're like seeking people in the day.
And thinking, now, they're more annoying than the other person. Maybe I should be dealing with them and, well, you know, does it matter? And
I don't think it does matter very much.
No, but, you know, you go through these...
Panics.
Yeah. You know, which is why, of course, generally, when I do the best part, obviously, and I enjoy it when I'm doing it with a group, but it isn't my first choice at all.
No. I think you're better off trying to sort of see it, well, what that range of people is trying to do is to get you to engage with the different possibilities of your heart, if you like. Yeah, so the friend, you're working with a tendency towards clinging, probably. Yeah, with a neutral person, you're working with a tendency towards sort of indifference. and with a enemy, or you're working with a tendency towards aversion, and they're your basic emotional responses, aren't they? So they're just being used as triggers, really.
Mm.
So it's like, well, how do I sit with my aversion without falling into it? Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
How can I sit with an object or person, an image of something which would normally generate aversion in me? How can I sit with that without falling into that aversion or without falling into that craving?
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? So yeah. You see them as ciphers rather than take it too literally. I mean, yeah, I'm always a little bit... I think it's fine to have a specific people, you know, but I wouldn't, I'd encourage people to let them choose you as far as possible and not worry about whether they fit the seemingly fit the category.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? It's a bit more like trusting something, you're trusting something a bit deeper in you, yeah?
Can I ask a question, actually? Maybe this is more for this question than just specifically Myth Bhavana. But is it really about not so much that you shouldn't have these feelings of dislike or hatred, but how you react to them?
No,
is that what the practice is more about? That it's not, Buddhism isn't teaching you that you shouldn't have these feelings, but maybe that you shouldn't react to them. Is that the correct interpretation, or is it obviously the ideal is that you shouldn't have them?
I think that's a valid interpretation. I don't think that is the correct interpretation, you know, there's not like one correct interpretation, but I think what you're saying is a very valid interpretation and understanding of Buddhism, yeah. But I think, like, with this practice, there's all sorts of levels you can experience it on, you know? So certainly one of the things you're trying to do is exactly as you say, learn not to react. So you can't do anything about those kind of primary feelings, you know? In the middle of the wheel of life, you've got greed, hatred and delusion. You know, I don't know if you know the wheel of life, but, you know, according to Buddhism, these are the central emotions that drive us. So it's not that we shouldn't have them. There's no should or shouldn't about it. The fact is we've got them. You know, that's how it is. You know, we've got them. You know, we have... You know, we tend towards either craving or aversion. That's what we tend towards, all of us. So in a way, you know, there's no should or shouldn't about it. But there is, yes, exactly as you say, there's a way of... I think what primarily we're trying to do, I mean, I was using the word abide. So I think we're trying to learn to abide with stuff, which implies that we're not kind of reacting to it. So we're not compounding it or keeping it going, kind of letting itself burn itself out in a way. That's one way you can look at it. If you sit with your anger, for instance, for long enough, if you can just sit with it, it will eventually kind of burn itself out if you're not constantly fueling it, yeah? But our normal reactive pattern is just to constantly put more and more fuel on it, if you like, and keep it going, you know? So yeah, you're quite right, yeah. Yeah.
I feel the first part of the practice is just wonderful, and I've doing some of the work with Yasha Bodhi on the precepts, I came to realize pretty much how important that first bit is, one's relation and appreciation, or abiding, whatever one wants to say, with oneself. But it's very, I find that quite difficult. You know, but you were talking about all those other people who come on my pick today. But when I first began Myth Bhavana, I was like a little soldier girl. You know, may I be happy? May I be
So thanks to some of the things that you've taught or guided one to, I found a way of doing it a bit more calmly or more gracefully or softly, but that's all a prologue. What other ones one's stuck? Yeah. You know, like, what else can one do besides say one's name quietly and feel it going into a deep well, as you suggested to us today?
I suppose what I'd say these days is that, you know, not just with the metta-bhavana, but more in generally, you can, yeah. I suppose I'm tending to talk about it as a turning towards. So if you're stuck, the turning towards is towards that stuckness in a way. So it's not so much that you're trying to get unstuck, it's that you're trying to come into relationship with what it feels like to be stuck. What does it feel like to be stuck? That's, it's a kind of rhetorical question, but, you know, that's the sort of thing I'd be encouraging people to ask themselves. If they feel stuck, well, what does that feel like? Where is it in the body? What does it feel like? If I think to myself, Christ, I'm really stuck in my life, I'm really stuck, how does that make me feel? What's there for that? So in a sense, you're turning towards whatever's there, and if stuckness is there, well, that's what you're turning towards. To the extent, you know, I mean, don't take this too literally, but to the extent that you're trying to become unstuck, you're not really being present with yourself. Do you see what I mean? To the extent that you want to be having some other experience. And I think basically, I mean, roughly speaking, and again, I don't know that this is always the case, but roughly speaking, I think we can talk about meditation as a process of engaging more and more fully with how we are and trusting that that full engagement with how we are has some sort of transformative effect. But we kind of have to trust that, you know, trust that if we fully engage with how we are, something moves, something that allows, that starts to open up something. But we can't do it in order to open up something, if you see what I mean, because then we're not quite fully engaging with ourselves. So it's a very delicate, and we never get it quite right, and that's fine. But it's a very delicate and subtle thing that we're trying to do. We're trying to come into full and sort of strong relationship with ourselves without actually alter it, you know, without actually wanting it to change in a particular way. It's analogous, really, to the mindfulness of breathing, is that when you become aware of your breath, it's quite hard to know whether you're controlling it or not. It's a kind of analogous to that in a way. We're trying to come fully into relationship with the breath, but allow the breath to breathe itself. And in a sense, this is what we're trying to do with the psyche, you know, without whatever our body of stuff is. We're trying to come fully into relationship with it without wanting to push it anywhere. Because once we want to do that, then it's the ego that's calling the shots, and that's not what we want, you know. We don't want the ego directing what's going on. But of course, that's more or less impossible, and we accept that's more or less impossible. We do it to what, you know, we do it more or less, you know. I think the best and easiest way analogy for that is discomfort in the body, you know. And I'm always saying, you know, I don't know that. I think for most people, the most direct experience, the gateway into this, very often, is learning to sit with physical discomfort. When you've learned to sit with physical discomfort without reacting to it, it's a kind of key, yeah? Well, this has been my experience, it's a kind of key that you can then learn, you can then think, it's possible to sit with emotional discomfort without reacting to it. You know what it feels like to have a physical sensation going on, be very aware of that physical sensation, but not to go into aversion, yeah? Mm. So, and I think that's a real, if you can get that physically, then somehow the penny maybe drops emotionally. You can do the same thing emotionally. You can be fully engage with your emotion of stuckness without going into aversion and thinking, well, I shouldn't be stuck. You know, once you think I shouldn't be stuck, you've fallen into aversion, haven't you? Yeah. So it's like, well, what? It's more like, well, what is this stuckness? What does it mean to be stuck? What's the image of stuckness? These are sort of questions that one would be interested in, you know? You know, from a meditative point of view, of just trying to come into relationship with it and very gently begin to tease it open, as it were. So there's always something you can do, and it's always really the same thing, to come more fully into a relationship with whatever your experience happens to be. Yeah. So it's always the same answer, really.
You used the word curiosity.
Yeah.
And that for me is what works for working with pain or physical or emotional. If I become curious about it, then that shift makes it possible. Instead of
Towards it with curiosity. Yeah, turn towards it. Emma Chodron says lean into it, doesn't she? She goes a bit further. Lean into it, yeah. I think it is the general working method, really. If you talk about a kind of general working method of meditation, it is, you know, this turning towards or leaning in or being curious, however you want to put it, you know, whatever words work for you, you know, as a sort of image.
But say something hurts physically so much if you're down on your cushion, like a sciatica pain, like really thwacking away, you know, sharp pain. Is that what you would suggest, just saying,
I would suggest moving, I would suggest moving, but you know, if that's here, isn't it? I mean,
sometimes you can release them.
You're getting a bit, yeah, of course you can. There's all sorts of ways you might better work with that pain, you know. But if you know simply moving it's going to relieve it, and it's a terrible pain, well, obviously you would do that, you know, because that would be an act of kindness, wouldn't it? So, you know...
Isn't the point that you don't react immediately,
you investigate when you need to move,
your threshold of pain, and what position you need to move to, so you move consciously.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than just a knee-jerk reaction.
I'm not suggesting kind of butchering out terrible pain. In a way, if you're doing that, you're in aversion, aren't you?
Yes.
That's a form of aversion. So you obviously you have to apply kind of just common sense, really. But unless you've got some physical injury, which unfortunately, of course, as we get older, more and more of us have, but actually... You know, it's not really that terrible. If you're often getting terrible pain in meditation, you obviously need to look at your posture. There's something wrong, or the way you're sitting isn't working for you, you know? And most of the discomfort we get in meditation is relatively mild, really. It's our leg going to sleep, it's getting itch. In that state, it can feel very strong. I can't stand. But actually, that's because you're tensing up around it. So it's quite... I'm talking about working with a level of discomfort which is workable. I'm not talking about... You know, but what do you do? I mean, it does raise the question, though, doesn't it? What do you do if you're in severe pain? You know, maybe in the end, the only workable way of working with, you know, the way to work with severe pain is the same, but, you know, I'm not really talking about that, so we're moving it into, you know, I'm talking about kind of discomfort, really.
Fidgeting
certainly comes into it, yeah.
guess it extends though to emotional pain that you might.
Of course,
overwhelming, and maybe you're not workable at that.
Moment. Well, this is fine. Yeah. If it's not workable, that's fine. You just accept that as well, don't you? You know.
The physical and the emotional are very. I find it hard to tell the difference.
Yeah,
absolutely. Because
I get distracted by really intense heart feeling. It's physical, but it's emotional. And I find that, you know, the aversion thing, going towards it and away from it. If I don't want it, or whether I don't want it, I have to drop down. And out of that way, I find it very distracting. But when I feel more settled in it, it's dropped down to sort of there. When it's up here, it's very distracting. You know, it's just very intense. Well, this is going to sound really trivial, but I found it much better than only having three stages. So I'm letting go. I think, oh, right, here we go.
It's a bit of a slog sometimes.
The five stages.
Which one am I in now?
How many bells have gone by?
I agree with
you. Can you talk about some sort of creative ways to keep your focus, especially on the people?
Do you want to keep your focus on the people? You're kind of assuming something there, aren't you?
Well, I think I do.
No, okay. Maybe that's not that important, really. I wouldn't get too obsessed with the people, in a way. So, I think it's very hard for me to sort of generalise about this, because personally, I find the simpler I keep it, the easier it is. So if I'm ever meditating, if I'm doing a metta bhavana and I'm with other people, I nearly always use people sitting by me, like we did tonight, because for me that's a lot easier. And this is personal, I'm not saying this is right? If I'm doing the metta bhavana, and let's say I'm on the friend, and some friend comes to mind, I might just sort of, I don't know, I sort of remember them in whatever way I remember them, and I just kind of sit. But I'm not really obsessed with kind of keeping them there necessarily. Do you know what I mean? I don't know that you have to sort of. I think in a way that's taking it a bit too sort of literally. As I said before, in a way you use. Well, there's lots of different ways we can think about this practice, but. In a way, you're just using that to trigger something. And you can just... One thing I'd say about this is I think people really find kind of difficult. And maybe this isn't... Again, I don't know that this is always true, but the way I've always approached this practice is to understand it as a mindfulness practice. And so the basic foundation of the practice is exactly the same as the mindfulness of breathing. For me, when I'm doing the metta bhavana, I'm still aware of my breath and my body, and that's kind of primary. And that keeps, you know, Rachel was gesturing down, that keeps some foundation, kind of some sort of ballast. Is found in the breath and the body, and then maybe I think a friend, someone comes to mind, and maybe I say their name or see an image or whatever, and then I'll just sit with that, I'll just kind of, that's it, but I'm not, and maybe, you know, a couple of minutes later I'll do it again, but I'm not trying to kind of crank something up or keep this glowing, do you know what I mean? So I think the thing is, this is my view, and I'm not saying this isn't necessarily going to be everybody's experience, but my way of thinking about this practice is that you've still got the samatha, you've got a basic calm, and without that, don't even attempt the practice. So the first thing we do with this practice is like any other practice, we try and establish some base, a foundation for it. And I would say the foundation is always found in some sort of awareness of the body and the breath. And when you lose the practice, you've usually lost that foundation. If you keep that foundation, the practice might be done on a very, very subtle sort of level, quite impressionistic maybe even. Do you know what I mean? So the person is just sort of quite a vague sort of feeling, but you're not distracted because you're breathing, you're with the heart, you're with the body, you're with the breath, you're with your emotion. And this trigger, it's just to sort of trigger this person. So I don't think, for me, that's a better way of looking at it and think there's this person out here and I've got to pump all this love to this person. And if I stop pumping the love, I'm not doing the practice right. But, you know, for other people, maybe that love pumping thing works. It's hard to say, isn't it? So I'm not saying there's a right, but I think you've got to find, so when you say creative, I suppose what's creative is to find a way of doing this practice or any other practice that kind of suits your personality. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, if you know, and how your mind works. So I don't know how other people's minds work, but I know how mine kind of works. You know, so I kind of, so, you know, I don't know if that helps, but I don't think the thing has to be a big production. So traditionally, in the Metta Sutta, if we go back to the earliest recordings we've got of this practice in the Pali Canon, it's not done towards individual people, it's done in directions. So you do it to the east, to the west, so you just do it geographically. You don't have, I don't know at what point individual personalities came out. So you just did it directionally, and it wasn't a sitting meditation, it was a contemplation that was done at any time, a constant sort of contemplation, if you see what I mean. So at some point it becomes a sitting meditation, and at some point it, you get different versions of it. This version we do is a bit unusual in that most versions you start with your teacher. But anyway, there's lots of different versions. So this is one particular version. Some versions you do your mother and father, and you do all women behind your mother and all men behind your father. So there's lots of different versions, and I would say with people, don't get too hung up about this particular structure. Try and get, I think with all meditation, we're looking for what's the essence. So this is, well, what's the taste of this meditation for you? What does it mean for you to be more loving? Well, how does that feel for you, and what, how can you get at that? And for some people, say, may you be well, may you be happy, is quite adequate, works quite adequately. It's a good method. For other people, it won't do anything. Do you know what I mean? So I think it's really trying to understand, well, be patient, really. Yeah, you know. You know, I'm struck more and more that there's something deeply ironic, paradoxical about meditation. It's the only way you can meditate is by using the qualities that you're trying to develop by meditating, yeah? So it's a very sort of weird, so the only way you can do the metta bhavana is by applying kindness. Of course, that's also what you're doing it to develop. And it's the same with mindfulness, you know, the only way you can do mindfulness of breathing is by being mindful of the breath, you know. So there's something very circular about the whole thing, you know. Something, yeah, it's kind of odd business, really. But I think the one thing we obviously don't want to do with a practice like the Metta Bhavana is to do it in such a way that we end up with more self-hatred than when we started. So that's the one thing, isn't it, that we really want to avoid. And it's actually, I think, something that people fall into quite easily. So once you start thinking, I can't do this practice, or I'm not doing it right, or it should be more, or it should be different, in a way, you've fallen into aversion, you've fallen into self-hatred, you know? So you're doing harm to yourself in a way. But that's one thing we need to avoid, although it's very difficult to avoid, isn't it? Yeah.
What were people doing when they were just turning east, west, north?
What do you mean, what they're doing?
Well, how does that relate to this practice at all?
Well, it just says, you know, you just do all the, may all beings in the eastern direction be happy. May all beings in the western direction. They just quite often did things by, you still get it. If you see people, if you see people going on pilgrimage, for instance, you know, you get some that prostrate every step to all the directions. It's a very traditional sort of way. It's like in the last stage, isn't it? It's sometimes done directionally. It's a very traditional way of doing it. There is a constant sort of, it's put as a constant contemplation. It says whether walking, laying or sitting, you know, you're sort of wishing all beings well all the time. So it's a constant kind of contemplation. That's what's being suggested. So then at some point it becomes a formal sitting meditation. So it's a bit different then. But I think, like with this meditation, but you know, another way you can look at it is you're just trying to remind yourself. Yeah? You're just using it as a way of trying to remind yourself in daily life. Because in the end, if you think nice things about someone on a cushion, yeah, it's kind of good, isn't it? But it's better to be nice to real people in the real world, isn't it? Maybe that's more of a practice for us. So you can think of our sitting practice as just trying to remind us that we have that aspiration, you know, we have an aspiration to be kinder in the world, you know. Maybe that's enough in a way, see it in that way, you know. I don't know.
I found it really helpful recently taking the kind of expectation of it, emotional expectation that I'm going to feel something for these people. But it still seems to have an effect maybe afterwards, rather than, oh, I'm not feeling anything, I'm doing it wrong, you were saying, to kind of just do it. Mm. Not to worry about if I feel something or not at the time. Mm. Seems to lay a foundation somehow in a more long term.
Yeah, I go with the person at the end for a long time and think, well, the object of all this is to change how I feel about the person at the end. But I might actually still feel, that hatred might not diminish.
I find sometimes that's quite difficult because the hatred actually increases.
Yeah.
You bring someone to mind and you think.
You become more conscious.
Yeah, exactly. They come into my mind quite fully and you get quite a strong reaction against them. I found I did it for a while. I didn't bring people I had difficulty up.
Yeah.
I didn't bring people I had difficulty with up in my meditation because I was seeing them on a daily basis and it seemed to kind of stir it all up somehow. I don't know what that was all about.
I don't find it an easy practice to do on a regular basis, but I do try to think, who am I going to meet today? Who am I going to encounter, you know, from my husband whom I live with, whom I obviously see all the time, to, you know, shopkeepers, people on tube stations, fellow students, all sorts of people, and just try and, wish good things for them. So it's a more in touch with what my life is actually like. And when I do find that I'm meeting the people I have difficulty with, I find I tell that beforehand and try not to get too angry with them.
It's really tricky, I think, because just think about what we're all talking about. As you said, it's a contrariness of trying to just be and be aware when you're sitting, right? But then we're all talking about imagination, and it's all more head trips that we get involved with. So there is a kind of pull and push, whereas with the mindfulness, it's easier because we're just sitting there.
Well, then,
you have to start using your head, your imagination.
Well, in a way, you're always using your imagination, but I know what you mean. But then, if that's how you feel, you start thinking, well, how can I strip this practice down and make it more like the mindfulness of breathing? So the person you're thinking about breathes as well, don't they?
We hope.
Well, if they don't, they're dead, aren't they? Yeah. But so they're breathing as well. So there you go. So there's already a link suggested, isn't there? Feel just what's it like? Just like we were trying to do tonight. What's it like just to sit there aware of your breathing body and another breathing body? I mean, I think there's also there's an insight aspect to this practice, a very strong insight aspect to this practice, which comes about through you experiencing yourself more and more as a manifestation of aliveness, if you like, yeah? So to the extent that you can experience yourself relatively free from your ego, to the extent that you're able to do that, the more naturally you will feel empathy with other living things. It will arise naturally. You know, this is one way of talking about the nature of insight in Buddhism. To whatever extent you allow your own ego to soften and open, there will be a natural resonance with life, yeah? You'll start realizing that this life is just the same life. There's not really, you know. And of course, once that happens, there's no problem about feeling empathy for other people, because you have a deep intuition about. If you start to really appreciate your own aliveness and what it's like for you to be a human being, yeah? I mean, I believe this very strongly. The more fully you experience yourself, the more naturally sympathetic, in the positive sense of that word, the more naturally sympathetic you're going to be towards other human beings. This is what the great novel teaches us, isn't it? You know, this is what makes a great novel, isn't it, or a great bit of art. You know, the people have had some real depth of experience of themselves, and that naturally brings them into relationship with the rest of life, you know. This is all we're trying to do. In a way, the first stage is so important, because if we do manage to experience ourselves fully and deeply, that experience is no longer something confined in this body. It's an experience of being in aliveness, being naturally, intimately connected with everything else. This is how Buddhism teaches us, you know. It says, well, this is how things really are. This is how things really are. And the way you experience things as they really are is primarily to experience yourself as you really are. And if you experience yourself deeply enough, then all these problems of whether he or she, like he or she or whatever, are put in their proper place. You know, they're put in a, they're not, they don't, it doesn't mean you won't have likes and dislikes anymore. It just means you won't take them particularly seriously in a way. They won't be what really matter, you know? You know, so the practice in the end is an insight practice. It's supporting insight, and that is, you know, it's no. So I think quite often with a lot of meditation and a lot of these practices, we're trying to solve problems on the level of the ego. On the level of the ego, life, we're always going to have likes and dislikes. We're always going to find life unsatisfactory. That's just how it is. we're not going to solve these things on the level of ego. So if we want to solve the metta-bhavana, if we see it as some sort of, we find it difficult, well, it's the ego that's finding it difficult, but you're never going to solve it on that level, because it's not really what that, it's not really pointing towards that level. It's pointing to a deeper level of yourself, a deeper experience of yourself. And when you contact that deeper experience of yourself, really these problems disappear, maybe. You know? Doesn't mean your ego is going to disappear. But I think you, maybe we slowly move towards a point where we just don't have to take it so seriously, you know, we don't take ourselves so seriously, in the positive sense of that idea, you know.
I'm just relating to what you're saying about imagination and what did you say? Head trip or something?
No, it's not.
I mean, I suppose that is the danger, isn't it? Is that you, when you kind of lose your grounding,
this tends to be my experience, is that I go into an imaginative flight of fancy. And there's something about the metta-bhavana that kind of encourages that more than the mindfulness of breathing. You think about this person and there's like this myriad of interconnecting thoughts about them. And it's a very fine line to walk between encouraging that discursive thought in an unhelpful way, so that your head becomes full of chatter about stories and things that are unhelpful. And somehow using your imagination, I'm always just baffled as to where that territory is between those two things, because it's so easy to go off into a sort of movie scenario or something, and then kind of, I think I know at that point I've lost it really. But then there's something good about being able to imagine different situations, but then there's also something unhelpful about it. It's quite strange. I don't know what that question is. It's kind of a sort of question.
Question?
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Like,
Well, I don't know. I don't feel qualified to answer that question, because I mean, this is what I mean. I think the only thing it...
There's so many interconnecting ways it could go.
Well, what it prompts in me is that different people's minds are very, very different, because I must say I don't have that problem, you see. It doesn't happen to me. I don't find myself going off into a movie, you know, the only way I can have to watch a movie, you know. I mean, my mind just doesn't seem to work like that in a way. So I think it's like one of the things we've all got to learn with meditation is to trust our own intuition, because we've all got very unique minds that work in our own particular way, you know. And it's like, in a sense, I can speak from my experience, and as I say, that's not really a problem. So for me, I don't really have this problem going into these complicated stories or scenarios. It's just not what my mind does, you know? So if I was to suggest, I'll just be bullshitting you, I'll just be making it out, you know?
It doesn't even have to be very complicated. It's just kind of like a sort of habit or a sort of pull or a sort of certain kind of set of...
Yeah, well, I wouldn't be interested in that, I think. See, for me, that sort of thing doesn't happen very often, so if it happens, and I think this is the big difference, and you have to trust this, you know, is it happening spontaneously, or are you kind of confecting it? And I think that confecting is not very useful.
Yeah.
But I think that happening, if I bring, you know, let's say I bring someone to mind and I get a vivid image or vivid memory, I'm interested in that image or memory. I don't think, oh, that shouldn't be there, or that's not meditation. Yeah. I'll turn towards that.
Yeah.
So I suppose my question is, where's this material coming from? And if it's coming from below, as it were, rather than some just... Otherwise, it's just that you're a bit bored, isn't it? And you're just sort of looking around for things to think about. And that's basically restlessness, isn't it? That's just basically a kind of restlessness. But if it isn't coming out of restlessness, well, I think it's probably valid material. Do you know what I mean? It's probably valid for you to dwell with or sit with. But again, unless you've got something that's anchoring you, I'm gesturing here, like, it's basically the breath that always anchors you. I mean, I think basically, unless you're very absorbed, when you meditate, it doesn't matter what practice you're doing, the breath probably should be there. And if it's not there, I personally think it's a bit questionable. Yeah, I mean, but again, I'm making a huge generalisation there, but that seems to be my experience. As I said, it is possible that sometimes you become very absorbed and the breath kind of goes, it kind of becomes more and more subtle and but that's got a very definite feel to it, and you know if that's happened. But other times, if the breath isn't kind of there, or when I say breath, I mean the breathing body, not just the breath as an ideal object.
Sensation in the present.
A present. So, that's exactly it, isn't it? We're using our physical sensation to keep us present.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're not present, well, I don't know where we are. But being present doesn't exclude the past. As I was trying to say before we meditated, actually, to be fully present in a way also includes your past in a way.
Yeah.
To be connected down into your history through your body in a funny sort of way. You're not disembodiedly present, if you know what I mean. I don't know if that makes sense to people, but, yeah.
It's kind of terrible, though. It's kind of a bit of terror there for me.
Yeah, sure. I think being present is very, very... it can be very blissful, it can be very terrifying. When one's got to ask the question, why is it that most of us, most of the time, aren't fully present?
Why?
Why?
Yeah.
Well, you'd have to answer that question yourself, wouldn't you, by self-observation. Starting to feel into those times when you turn away. You know, why is it that we're always, most of it, I don't know, maybe you're not, but I think a lot of the time we are more or less subtly turning away from our experience. We're trying to control our experience, you know. We can't quite relax into our experience fully, you know. But why? I don't know why.
Sometimes I suppose we're trying to do too much at the same time.
Yeah, you know, maybe. Maybe.
Very simple things. Oh, a problem you're trying to solve, you're trying to work as well, you've got to pay a bill, and somehow...
You're gliding over the top of everything.
You're just doing, you're sort of skirting or skiing over the top. And rather than just think, pay the bill,
then
go and make a cup of coffee, and then do the work, you know, you tend to always have these at least half a dozen slightly multitasking, and also doing very probably inefficiently. And the people I'm often impressed with, when you actually go in, or even people you don't know very well, who seem to be able to look you in the eye, even if you meet people at a party or somebody invites you to dinner, you don't know them, and they completely engage with you, it's very impressive. And listen to what you're saying, and then the next minute they're probably utterly engaged. You know, it isn't because they fall in love with you or anything, it's just all find you very interesting, but then they engage with somebody else. And somehow, I think it's a great skill and strength to be able to do that, to have that. And I think that's what we have to try and do in our sort of smaller lives.
Babies do that.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah,
that's
my only demand that you hold that
feeling. Present and okay with being present in life
as
being
the
small thing.
Funny, I think of this woman I know who's she's been bringing up this kid who's very badly disabled. He's blind and he's got all sorts of things wrong with him. And it's, when you meet her, just to be with her is quite a remarkable experience. She's just really, really present. And I guess she's had to be like this because of this kid, you know. She's learned to be present with this kid, you know. Just I could imagine, unless you're very present with this kid, you just, because of all its difficulties, you know what I mean? Anyway, it's hugely impressive, you know. It's hugely... kind of, you know, always really struck. She's just there, and she's with you in a way that is so rare, you know, these days. So rare, you know, for people to be fully with each other, I think, you know. But I think I would suggest it's probably rare for most of us to be fully with ourselves, you know. And I think that's the thing about meditation, isn't it? It is an opportunity to be fully with yourself. And perhaps that in itself is an act of loving kindness. So, you know, in a way, that's another layer of it. We can think, well, I don't have to try and generate loving kindness. It is loving kindness just to sit with myself in my discomfort, in my abstraction, in my whatever, just to sit as fully with myself as I can is a kind of act of loving kindness, you know. Maybe that's the real root of it, in a sense, you know, this willingness to be with, to abide with ourselves as fully as we're able.
And that's automatically kind for others, like that.
Totally.
Bestow something on some
blessing, yeah. It blesses other people, actually. I think that's the other thing. The more present you are with people, the more that offers them a possibility of being present, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, not that they will necessarily take it, but it does offer it to them. As you were saying, you know, you are affected by it, aren't you? You know, you do. Yeah. But it is quite rare, I think.
Well, it's
rare.
Scary.
It is scary.
So strong.
Yeah.
You have to rehearse it and get and become stronger.
But in another way, it's just a very natural, ordinary way of being, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, like we get it with animals, don't you, or whatever, you know, they're present. Yeah. And I suppose, you know, then what's interesting is to start thinking, well, what stops you being present? And in the end, it's the same old answers. In a way, it's always aversion and craving. You know, if you're in aversion or craving, of course, you're not really present.
Mm-hmm.
You're always moving towards or moving away from, you know. Mm-hmm. You always want some result from it, so that sort of, and so that, this is why I say we met above, and we want to be careful that we don't bring a sort of subtle craving into our practice, you know, which of course we all will, but I think we need to just be aware of that, not paranoid about it, but just aware that we're probably always going to do that, but we can do it more or less, you know. But I think we can learn, you know, to abide with, just to sit with our experience more and more.